This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's been a lot of discussion in the past few weeks about who should be able to use what bathroom. This all has to do with gender identity and the rights of transgender people to use facilities that conform to their gender identity rather than the sex that was assigned to them at birth and may be on their birth certificate. In Vermont, birth certificates can be changed for people who can prove they've undergone sexual reassignment treatment. Last week, the Obama administration issued a new directive to schools that receive federal funding. It says schools must allow students to use the bathroom that conforms to their gender identity. Even before the federal guidance came out, the Vermont Agency of Education had already issued its own set of guidelines to the state's schools. Vermont's guidelines forbid schools from requiring transgender students to use bathrooms that don't conform with their identity, but it does suggest that schools can include gender-neutral bathrooms in considering how to structure bathrooms. This hasn't meant that it's been smooth sailing for schools around the state as they navigate these issues. Bruce Williams is superintendent of schools at the Two Rivers Supervisory Union. That includes Green Mountain Union High School in Chester. Students at that school staged a protest last week over what they felt was discrimination against a transgender student who'd been instructed to use a gender-neutral bathroom rather than the boys' or girls' restroom. Superintendent Williams happened to be at the high school the day of the walkout. I talked with him yesterday about the event, and he told me that he, the principal, the vice principal, and a school counselor went outside to meet with the 30 students who were protesting.
The students were respectful. They were intense. They were very, very committed to this cause, but they were very respectful, and they had actually gone out of their way to try to do this sit-in with the least amount of disruption to other students as possible, but still make their point. So we had a conversation. We listened. They listened. We talked about a process for getting their views heard and considered, not least of which was potentially coming to the school board meeting on Thursday night, which several of the students did do.
When you say that they recognized there was something of value in making that statement, it sounds like you think there was something of value in them making that kind of statement as well.
That's very true. I think that Mr. Ferentz and the school board and myself, I think we all viewed this as a learning opportunity, and I think the students conducted themselves with class. And, you know, we also wanted to make sure that these students knew that there were other voices in the community, there were other concerns, and that there would need to be a process that we would have to go through before we'd reach any kind of a resolution. But, you know, I do think that we saw real value in what the students were doing.
You know, one of the things that's interesting about this situation that makes it different from some of the situations we're hearing about in other states was that the student in question was being advised to use a gender-neutral bathroom. And the students at Green Mountain Union High School said, that's not acceptable. That's not enough, because that does make this student feel other in some way. You know, this student has to use a different bathroom when the rest of us use the boys' room or the girls' room. And so what's the solution?
Well, yeah, no, I think it's a great question and not a simple question. I think that to that extent, our consciousness was raised. I do think the Green Mountain administration had been working hard and thought that creating so-called gender-neutral bathrooms was a sufficient solution. And I think the students were making the very point that you just made, that that's not sufficient. And after, you know, really thinking it through, listening to them, looking at the law, getting some good advice from our own attorney, I mean, we were generally pointed in a direction of changing the policy fairly quickly, and I think he definitely reinforced that. And then the Agency of Education, in a similar fashion, gave us advice that generally underlined the direction we were headed. And in point of fact, I think the Agency of Ed realized that their own directives on this issue, which tried to embrace the complexity of the issue, maybe had, as a result, hadn't been as clear as perhaps they could have been. And to their credit, they adjusted and issued a very clear interpretation of the law, almost in sync with what was happening at Green Mountain High School. And we really appreciated that as well.
And so the solution that you've come up with is all of the bathrooms will become single stall bathrooms that are just called bathroom or restroom.
Yep, it's really simple.
So how long does it take to get to that point? Because, I mean, that's not necessarily an easy proposition.
That's correct. The solution's simple, the logistics not so simple.
Yeah.
Although, you know, this school had made a fair amount of progress in that direction already, and it was just, it was really just a changing of the labels. There are some community bathrooms that are a little bit more challenging. And
these are bathrooms that have more than one stall
exactly.
in them?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, analyzing that and making those adjustments as quickly as reasonably possible is already underway.
What kind of feedback are you getting from parents in the district?
So, you know, I don't know if the superintendent of schools gets the most direct feedback. You might, maybe,
uh-huh.
you know, the principal might get it. I certainly have gotten a number of supportive comments. I've literally gotten no negative comments. I've gotten some people who sort of dispute the wisdom of what we're doing, but they're very respectful comments, just differing in their viewpoint.
Why? What do they say?
I think it's mostly they don't believe this phenomenon is real. They just don't accept the concept of transgender.
Hmm.
It's a concept that some people just don't accept.
Hmm.
And so for them, it becomes an odd proposition to create an issue where they see none.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lack of appreciation, really, of an individual's self-determination.
That was Bruce Williams, superintendent of Two Rivers Supervisory Union. That includes Green Mountain Union High School in Chester. Last week, some students there protested what they felt was discrimination against a transgender student, and it led to a supervisory union change in policy, as we just heard about. We're looking at how Vermont schools are changing policies or working to put into practice policies that acknowledge that students have a right to self-determination when it comes to gender identity. Joining us now for this discussion is Vermont Secretary of Education, Rebecca Holcomb. Nice to have you with us again, Secretary.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Dana Kaplan, Director of Education for Outright Vermont. It's an advocacy organization for LGBTQ youth. Dana, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Holcomb, that idea of self-determination that Superintendent Bruce Williams mentioned is actually central to the document that your agency sent out to Vermont schools in March with some best practice guidelines for schools in addressing the needs of both transgender and gender fluid and gender nonconforming students. And you say in that document that the core principles are that all students have a gender identity which is self-determined, all students have privacy rights, all students have a right to feel safe at school, and all students have a right to a school environment free from discrimination. So if those were the principles that you're starting from, how did they lead you to specific guidelines?
Well, that's a challenging question. I think the principle is that every student is who the student is, and we work with every student, no matter who they are, how they identify, to make sure that they feel safe and respected. And what that looks like has to be discussed openly with the child and make in a way that makes sure that that child is actually supported in the environment. And that applies to all students. You know, I think Bruce spoke so eloquently to this issue, and I think, you know, I think in my own experience of a family friend who spends every day worrying about whether his transgender child will be alive at the end of each day, I think about some of the young transgender Vermonters I've met who've shared their stories with me over the last year, who really struggled with anger and frustration until they were able to transition and operate with the identity that really fit their knowledge of themselves and allowed them to live that coherent life. And I think also of parents of transgender children who say simply, my child just wants to be living happy. And what all of these stories have in common, and this is common, I think, to all children, is that people just want to be safe to be who they are, whoever they are, and not afraid that their identity is going to cause other people to want to do them harm, but also that they will be accepted for who they are and what their identity is. And so I think the principle behind these best practices was to try to lay out some of the kinds of nuance and some of the complexity that schools might encounter as they tried to figure out how to make their school environments responsive to and supportive of the needs of students so that they could be able to be in our schools and thrive.
But, you know, that's where the complication is. As we just heard from Bruce Williams, the Chester school thought, well, we have these restrooms that, you know, are not gender specific. And so if we have a gender nonconforming student, this is a good solution because it allows everybody to feel comfortable. And what the students who were protesting in support of their friend said is, no, that's still making our friend feel like a different kind of person because, you know, because we use one bathroom and AJ uses another. So Dana Kaplan, I mean, it's one thing to say we all have a right to self-determination, but that then leads to policies that are going to help determine whether somebody feels comfortable or not.
But can I just interject? I think the difference is that in that case, the students have a right to choose whether they use the gender-neutral bathroom or the gender-specific bathroom.
Not in that case, though. The student had been asked
right.
to use a gender-neutral
and
bathroom.
And what our recent guidance says is it's the student's right to decide to use the bathroom that is consistent with their identity. And I think that's the fundamental difference.
Right. And I think that what's important to recognize, too, is that there's not one narrative, and there's not going to be one specific roadmap for here's how you do it to accommodate all trans students and all non-binary students. If that student had said, this is wonderful, I need to be able to use a gender-neutral bathroom because I don't want to have to think about my gender when I go to the bathroom, I just want to do my thing and get out, then great, we want to have those options for those students. We hear from youth around the state that they want more single bathrooms and gender-liberated bathrooms. So it's not saying get away with those bathrooms, but it is saying what's right for this particular student was that he wanted to go pee in the men's room, really, right? It's that simple. And that another trans student, what is going to feel most comfortable to them is to be able to go to the bathroom where gender is not a determinant of what door they go into.
Listeners, I'd love to get your input on this as we have this discussion. Are you aware of how schools are addressing issues with transgender students in your district? Have you been active in helping to craft policy or thinking about how this is working? Maybe it's something that's pretty crucial to your family life. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from a listener who says, I want to thank Outright Vermont and the Department of Education for these very thoughtful and supportive guidelines. These are life-saving guidelines. All children need the love and support of family, friends, and school. Trans kids need this even more. Without this support, 41% of trans people attempt suicide. With this support, that number plummets. If one of these three pillars of support are weak or missing, lives can easily be lost. In a nationwide parent of trans children support group I'm in, we've had 2 suicides and 2 attempts in just the past week. My trans child has and had strong support in all of these areas, best school and friends and family ever, and it has still been an extremely hard journey. We've been so lucky to have an amazing school administration, amazing school staff, open and accepting peers, and full support from extended family. I wish this type of love and support for all children, trans or not. So again, you can share your experience with us or your thoughts or your questions. 1-800-639-2211. So, Dana Kaplan, what do you think of the state of Vermont's guidelines, which, again, came out in March, well before the federal guidelines that have been really making a splash this week?
Yeah, I think that the guidelines are incredible. I think that it's giving the state a roadmap. We now have something to look at for us to be able to have the Agency of Education take this lead. We're super grateful for that. I think that the secretary is using power to be able to say, this is how we do it in Vermont, and I think that it's critical. It doesn't mean that everybody then knows how to follow that map, right? You give me a great map, and if I can't read those directions, I still might get lost. So there's a lot to be done in terms of sitting with school communities and having conversations around what does this look like in action, and professional development so folks can get the questions answered that they're having. But I think it's a tremendous start, and we're so grateful that the guidelines are there.
Secretary Holcomb, what did make the Agency of Education decide to put out these guidelines and best practices for Vermont schools?
I think there were several reasons we did it. And first of all, I'll thank Dana Kaplan for helping to introduce me to a number of young trans youth who were able to share some of their stories with me. One of the other things that we were seeing statewide is a growing number of schools reaching out to us because an increasing number of students were entering school and identifying as transgender at earlier and earlier ages. And we're really looking for thoughtful and meaningful ways to support these children and make sure that they felt safe and that they were supported as they came into school. And also realizing, and I think Dana Kaplan spoke to this as well, that this is, it's much easier to say this is the principle that we want to operate under. It's a little bit more challenging to sometimes figure out what that looks like on the ground. And we were in a position to and receive support from members across the state of Vermont in terms of looking at what available guidance was there in other states that could inform our work, but also to really begin this conversation of what are the kinds of cultural changes and what are the kinds of conversations we need to have to actually operationalize these principles in a real school context, given the diversity of schools and the different physical structure of some of our schools and the different grade levels of different schools across the state. So, you know, we've also been certainly tracking the evolving legal context. And one of the reasons we were able to issue that recent memo about the decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals is we'd been waiting to see where it came down and feel that our schools deserve the information as soon as they can so that they can use and make all the decisions they make to keep children safe, fully informed. And that's really our responsibility as the agency. I want to just address the other point that Dana made, which is that this is a hard transition for many, many educators as well. I spoke with an educator recently who I really see as a very long time, very strong proponent of equity issues in the state. And ethically and intellectually, she says she knows this ruling is right, and it's the only way to really support and protect the rights of this group of individuals. But she also acknowledges that she's struggling as a longtime educator to figure out how to do it personally. And the fact that she's even struggling with it makes her uncomfortable because she knows it's the right thing to do. And I want to offer that because I do know that this is a hard change. And I want to acknowledge that even as we work to make sure every kid feels safe, we have to acknowledge that this is calling on a lot of us, including our educators, to move out of comfort zones and to ask some really hard questions about our assumptions about gender and how those assumptions sometimes may shape not only always for the better the lives of some of our students. And if we really want to make sure that every one of those children feels valued and supported and doesn't end up being one of the 70% of transgender kids who feels harassed at school, we need to really think about how we create environments that prevent that from happening.
And we're going to talk more about that. How do schools actually do this? And, you know, how do they work with people like Dana to say, okay, I agree with the principal, but how do I put this into practice? But first, let's go to Al, who's calling in from Mendon. Hi, Al. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Jane. Good afternoon. Hey, I'm not sure if this experience directly correlates to the educational system or not. I was a corporate officer and general manager of a Fortune 200 company in New York City going back 1976 or so, and we had an employee, one of some 2,100 home office employees who was transitioning from male to female. We had the standard male-female restrooms on some 35 floors on 57th Street. And the employee came to me and indicated that he was going through psychological as well as physical transitioning from male to female. And we mapped out a program with our management to inform employees that this was happening. This was a well-accepted employee. He was 24, 25 years of age. And the program of education went very, very well. He was accepted as he transitioned from using the male restroom to female restrooms. And there were absolutely no issues whatsoever. It went about as smoothly as anything, in fact, I've ever managed in my life. So it can be done with the right attitude and with education.
Al, thanks for your experience. Worth remembering here. You know, the conversation has focused of late a lot on schools and a lot on bathrooms, but there's a lot of other kinds of conversations to be had as well. We got a note from Jessica, who shared her own experience as a recently out trans woman, and she writes, "I get an amazing amount of support and kindness living in Burlington. I also see the glares, the stares, and the comments. I watch the woman in the store where the clerks treat me with love and respect clutch her child closer to her as I pass. I see parents cross the street away from me. I get mocking wolf whistles and slurs." And Jessica writes, "I accept this. But as trans issues come more to the front in the media and public discourse, even here in Burlington, I feel the reactions I get becoming more pointed. At the same time, my allies hold me closer and stand up for me more. As far as the bathroom goes, I go out of my way not to make anyone else uncomfortable. But if I walk in the wrong male restroom, I can fear for my safety. If I walk in the wrong women's restroom, at worst, I feel like I'll scare someone. Hopefully, if a woman sees how terrified I am and knows I have not assaulted anyone, they'll be a little bit more comfortable." We're talking today about, in some cases, the experience of being a young transgender person or being transgender in Vermont. And we're looking specifically at how Vermont schools are addressing the needs of transgender or gender fluid students in their populations, and what reactions within the student body and among parents have been like when schools have been making changes. As I mentioned, coming up, we'll talk with Dana Kaplan and Rebecca Holcomb about how Vermont schools are actually doing this and how Dana works with schools to try to address these kinds of issues. And we'd love to hear more from you. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking about some of the ways Vermont schools are addressing the needs of their students when it comes to gender identity. The federal government's new directive on bathroom use for transgender students was preceded by instruction on best practices from the Vermont Agency of Education for the state's public schools. We are talking with Vermont Secretary of Education Rebecca Holcomb and with Dana Kaplan. He's Director of Education for Outright Vermont. It's an advocacy organization for LGBTQ youth. And we'd love to hear your perspective or your questions. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Dana, we were hearing earlier from Secretary Holcomb about how, you know, these guidelines have been issued to schools about here are the principles and here are some guidelines for best practices. How, though, do schools who say, okay, how do I actually make this work? You know, what questions do they have? How do you help address, you know, here's what you need to know about that idea of self-determination and making sure that all of your students feel safe and protected?
Yeah, well, first, I do want to just give a shout out to the youth and families that really helped to raise this issue. I think that oftentimes when we get phone calls, it's about administrators who are saying, hey, we need some help here. We've got a student who has been, you know, willing to share themselves with us, and we know that we need to figure out how to do this from here. So really just want to make sure that we're being mindful that there really are amazing youth and families out there that are helping to lift up the level of dialogue and competency that we're trying to create in Vermont. I think that what we know to be true from national school climate surveys is that there's really a couple of areas that we can look at when it comes to creating a safe and affirming school. One of those things is looking at the school's policies. So what do the policies say? Another really is looking at professional development. So giving adults within the school, educators, administrators, the opportunity to kind of flex their own muscles and say, okay, where are my biases around gender showing up? What do I need to be working on in my classroom? How can I change my language so that I'm inclusive of everybody here? Providing student supports. So we know that having gender and sexuality alliances within schools, having a safe and supportive place where students can be with each other and feel empowered to raise awareness and create change within their school is critical. And then having inclusive curriculum, which can often be sort of the hardest thing to get at, but is so essential for students to be able to focus on their lessons. Really, I want to be able to see myself reflected in the curriculum. I want to be able to go to the library and read a book that has a family that mirrors my experience, and to not feel left out. Because really what so much of this is about is making sure that everybody within Vermont schools is having equal access to education and opportunities.
Rebecca Holcomb, what kind of feedback or even pushback, honestly, are you getting from schools on how to do what your agency has directed?
Honestly, the feedback we've gotten has been mostly appreciation and thanks. I think, as Dana said, I think schools are eager to grapple with this because they are there. Educators come into this profession because they want to support children, and they realize that if students don't feel safe and included, they don't learn. And so what we've heard in response to the initial guidance was gratitude. Thank you for giving us some rules of the road so we can begin to have these conversations locally. That said, we do know that that people are looking for opportunities for professional development. They do want to do the kind of work that Dana just described. And there are some challenges in some of our facilities around making sure that we really are creating facilities that allow all students, and frankly, it's not just transgender students, it's all students to have privacy when they feel like they need it. And that is an ongoing challenge for some locations.
Let's go to Kristen, calling in from Orleans. Hi, Kristen. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I didn't realize the first person to whom I spoke was not the comment, so I hope I phrased it correctly.
Kristen, I think you spoke with our call screener, so just go ahead and tell us what you're on the air now. So go ahead and start over and tell us what you're thinking.
Okay, without any malice, and I truly have none, and as a teacher of 29 years, I have to say that I think we are going down the wrong road and doing a disservice to kids and adults by pretending that we can create an alternative reality for them. And I think our efforts, even with the best intentions, our efforts would be better served to just help support and help teach to navigate through what reality is for everybody. And I don't mean the tiny fraction that of people who are, you know, born with ambiguous gender, you know, through biological accidents. You know?
Kristen, when you say a different reality or that we're suggesting a different reality, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean for a little girl to just decide one day she'd rather be a boy or you know, use the language, I am a boy. You know, that to me, that's an alternative reality. It's not true. The person is a girl or a boy at birth, right? I hope we agree. And at some point decides to become the other. You know,
Kristen, let me put your point here to Dana Kaplan. And I think, you know, what there is agreement on is that for most babies, they're born with sex organs. And so gender identity may be different from sex organs. And that's part of the question that we talk about. So somebody's biological body may be different than what their self-identity is. And the school's guidelines, the Agency of Education says each student has a right to self-determination when it comes to gender. So what about this idea, though, that Kristen is feeling like this is the wrong path, Dana?
Well, it sounds like that's not Kristen's reality. And I think, you know, it would be great for Kristen to get to sit with a group of youth and families and be able to really breathe for a second and realize that just because that's not your reality doesn't make it any less valid and real for the folks that it is. And as an educator, I would hope that there would be room for Kristen to be able to go, let me take in what's being said here, because I do want to make sure that all Vermont youth feel safe in schools, even if that's not my experience.
Rebecca Holcomb, how do you, as Secretary of Education, you know, help people like Kristen who disagree with the guidelines that you're putting forth?
Well, the guidelines are the guidelines in that a student has the right to determine what their identity is and to identify and to use the facilities consistent with their identity. And it wouldn't be my place to tell a student that I don't agree with their identity. That's their right to self-determination. My job as an educator is to figure out how to make sure that the environment I'm creating is one that supports all members of our civil society and of our public school population. I would say that change is hard, and our school fronts are inevitably at the front of this kind of change. More than any other institution, they're really tasked with forcing us to have these hard conversations about what it means and looks like to live in a pluralist democracy. We have to work towards a shared goal, which is making sure every child feels supported and safe enough to come to the educational table and take advantage of all the rich opportunities we're trying to offer them. We love and hate our schools because they are vehicles for our aspirations, but they're also reflections of our challenges. And one of our challenges is figuring out how to handle this issue of gender identity. And we still have to have this conversation. And so I would just challenge all of us to do the brave thing and think about what it means to make sure that every child, even ones who maybe see the world through different eyes than our own, feel welcome in our classrooms and at our educational table.
You know, Kristen, I think, mentioned that she was a teacher for 29 years. We got another note from Melanie in Shaftesbury who says, I just asked my son, who's a high school senior, how many transgender and fluid gender kids are in his circle. He seemed bored by the question, but said he knows 4 fluid and 3 trans kids, pretty much evenly split between those whose birth certificates read male or female. I asked him which bathroom they use, and he, still uninterested, said whichever one they want. Who cares? I asked him what the school policy is, and he said he has no idea. Melanie says he clearly felt it wasn't my business or his, and I couldn't agree more. Dana, you know, part of that is generational. So, you know, we heard from Kristen who, and we see in statistics some generational splits. But I'm also curious your reaction to Melanie and her son, because, you know, their reality is this is not an issue, and that may well be his reality in school, but not necessarily for kids who are trying to go through this.
Yeah, well, I think that there's beauty in what Melanie is saying, which is that oftentimes, I mean, what I'm hearing in that, too, is that oftentimes this really is a matter of adults doing the work that they need to do, because youth, I mean, that's the beauty of working with youth, is that they are going to continue to push us to create change, and they're on the forefront here, and I think that it's our job to keep current with them, right? For educators to keep current with youth. I also think that it's just critical for adults to recognize the power that they have within school systems, because they are the ones that set the tone. And so if I react and say, yeah, you know, John is a boy and he loves to wear dresses and that's what he feels good in, now go outside, it's time for recess, great, that conversation is over, you know? That so much of it is about the script that we put forth.
Let's go to Tracy, who's calling in from Chester. Hi, Tracy, nice to talk with you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What are you thinking
about?
I'm
losing you.
No, we hear you. We've got you loud and clear, Tracy.
Okay, good.
So tell me, my understanding is you called in, you are actually AJ's mom, and AJ is the student in Chester whose friends were protesting to say AJ should be able to use the boys' room if that's what he wants to use. So I'm glad you called, and tell us what you're thinking.
Well, I just wanted to call in, coming into the conversation a little bit late. I was out at a client's house, and someone texted me that they were talking about AJ, so I tuned in, and I really just want to express my gratitude to the state, to the agency of education, and to my child's school, to AJ's school, to the administrators, to AJ's peers, to people who are standing up for what's right. Because as someone pointed out earlier, the suicide rate among trans people is incredibly high. Even with the support that AJ has, it has been a struggle. And it breaks my heart to think what kids who don't have this level of support feel. And so schools can really set the tone and have the ability to do the work that needs to be done at a very grassroots level. And I just want to express my undying gratitude for everything the state has done and for everything the school has done. Dana, AJ loves you. And I just wanted to thank everyone.
Tracy, I'm glad you called. Thank you. And I'm glad that somebody texted you and said this was our topic today. It's nice to hear from you. You know, Dana, Tracy calling in there talking about the difficulties that her son has had to go through despite all of this support, and sort of expressing both gratitude and, you know, it sounds like wanting people to have an understanding that this is still a path that's really difficult, even with the support of a school system.
Yeah.
And Rebecca Holcomb, I'm interested to hear from you. You know, it sounds like Vermont is in a really different place, at least in terms of policies. And I would never suggest that we don't have any discrimination. I think that's something that many Vermonters think and is clearly not true. But policy-wise, we're in a very different place than a lot of other states. We see states saying they're going to go against the new federal guidelines on policies for transgender students. Where do you, or how do you sort of negotiate placement among your peers in other states who are grappling with similar issues, but maybe from very different perspectives?
Well, I think they think we're a little bit of an outlier. I don't know if it's the personal nature of Vermont. I mean, you know, I want to go back to something Dana Kaplan said earlier. I remember sitting down at Outright and listening to a group of young transgender students talk about their journey and how compelling it was. And I think it's a privilege of Vermont that we are able to have those conversations and to really at the agency level, be able to have our finger a little bit on the pulse of what's going on at the ground level in our schools. So it allows us to think about how to craft and cultivate policy that really is consistent with what needs to be done to take care of our children. And these are all our children. And I actually think this policy is good not just for transgender children, but for children of all gender identities. You know, I think that makes us a little bit unique, perhaps, in the federal landscape.
Well, Dana, you must have been also watching the federal landscape and looking at the federal directive from the Department of Education and thinking about where things stand in this country and in Vermont. What else do you think needs to be done in terms of getting to a place where all people feel safe and feel respected?
I think some of this is about changing the conversation that we're all having around gender and what gender means and how to sort of liberate the ideas that are out there about how we do gender, right? I think that's part of it, is for all of us to locate ourselves in this conversation, because there are ways that we are all impacted by messages of stereotypical notions of what it means to be masculine or feminine, and that until we locate ourselves in this conversation, that there's much more work that needs to be done. So I think that's a big step. I think that it is critical that young trans and gender creative youth have role models that they can see themselves in older adults that are leading happy and healthy lives. I mean, I like to think I'm an okay person, but part of that notion of AJ loves you, I think, is look at, I can see older folks who are living their lives and it's okay to be me. It sends the message that I get to belong. I get to take up space. And I think that's a lot of the power of what we do at Outright Vermont is to create those programs and those spaces where kids can come and connect and feel like who they are is okay in a world where a lot of the time on a daily basis the messages that they get subtly or not so subtly are that that they're not okay.
Outright Vermont is an advocacy organization for LGBTQ youth. Dana Kaplan is director of education for the organization. Dana, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We've also been talking with Vermont Secretary of Education Rebecca Holcomb. Secretary Holcomb, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, a big exhibition of Native artwork is going on at several galleries and venues throughout Montreal. We'll talk with one of the curators of the Contemporary Native Art Biennial, next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In Montreal right now, there's a major exhibition of contemporary art going on, the third iteration of the Contemporary Native Art Biennial. It's big, spanning four venues with the work of over 50 First Nations artists from across North America. One of the big movers behind the exhibition is Mike Patton. He's an artist and independent curator and a member of the Saccame Nation. He curated the exhibitions at two of the venues and co-curated at another. And he joins us now from Montreal. Mike Patton, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Yes, hello.
Give us the bird's eye view of what this exhibition is all about.
Well, the title of the show is Culture Shift. And It's a reference to the Idle No More movement, which was the largest indigenous mass movement in Canadian history. And I was thinking of Idle not only in terms of inaction, but as a vehicle with the engine running, and the idea of shift as a culture shifting gear and gaining momentum. And since that movement and many other events, you can kind of see that there's a increased number of projects relating to Native art. And so that's kind of how I came up with the idea, culture shift.
And so when you talk about this theme of culture shift, how does the artwork in this exhibition represent a culture shift and some of the themes that are emerging in Canadian culture in general when it comes to First Nations people?
Sure. Well, one of the pieces that's kind of emblematic of the show is a piece by Ludovic Boni. It's a large 10-foot diameter metal sculpture, and it's seen as kind of a puzzle piece that's being held together by shipping straps. So it's using these kind of modern elements as hardware rather than traditional media. And it's indigenous art without having to, it doesn't like have the same kind of traditional elements. So it's kind of much different. And I really wanted to highlight some works like that just something very, very contemporary.
So in some cases, the work takes on a political overtone or undertone, and in some cases it doesn't. And both of those are equally represented and equally valid in this sort of view of the exhibition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So why is it then important to highlight Native art and to preserve an exclusive space for it?
Just because I think it's important to acknowledge the land that we're on, and you know, it kind of continues the relationship and betters the relationship between the indigenous culture and other cultures, because we're all living here together. And I think the exhibition helps bridge that communication between those two.
You know, so I mentioned that this is in four different venues, and you've been a part of at least three of them very intensely. Could you give us a sense, if we could fly in a drone, of what the artwork and the layout would look like? You know, get us sort of into this exhibition.
Sure. Well, we're the one of the main galleries, and it's on two floors. it's a massive space. I think we have 21,000 square feet total in the building, but we have the first two floors dedicated to the exhibition. Big high ceilings. Did you want to hear more about the art?
Yeah, I want to hear, you know, if I were flying as a bee or a drone, what would I be looking at? You mentioned Ludovic Bonnet. What else?
Yeah, sure. Also, next to Ludovic's work is Melissa General. And what you see is, you see these photographs of nature, but you see these kind of diagrams drawn in white on top. And when you first look at that image and you read it, for me anyway, when I saw it, it looked as if it was architectural plans, like, this is where we're going to cut apart the land or build this, or this is going to change. But actually, when you read the statement of the artist, these are designs based on dresses that she'd wear as a child. So it's kind of a collaborative piece with her mother. And the photographs that you see are photographs from the region where she lives. So I kind of like that you can have that double kind of reading. That's next to Ludovic's work. In the back room, another featured piece is by Wally Dion, and he's living in the Burlington area. And it's a process piece. He kind of constructed this staircase almost. And over a period of a year, he poured pigment and acrylic medium down. So it's kind of like this waterfall of different tone colors. And there's drip pans. You can see this stepped pattern of flowing color. So that's another piece that's quite striking. And I think it is emblematic of the show.
Mike Patton is one of the curators of a big exhibition of Native art going on in Montreal right now. Mike, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about the Contemporary Native Art Biennial.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
It's time now for our mailbag, and I'm joined by our executive producer, Patty Daniels. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Jane. So we're going to start with dress codes. Last week, VPR's Rebecca Sinanis reported on a community meeting in Woodstock about how the dress code at the middle school is being enforced. And some community members there felt the school was sending a message that girls should dress conservatively so as not to distract boys. Mm. The school says that wasn't the message it intended to send, but it's also led to an intense conversation over the last few weeks about sexism, objectification, and clothing.
And Christina wrote in with this reaction. How about encouraging our 11 to 14-year-old daughters to respect themselves in this hypersexualized culture and to take responsibility for the image they project? They're young, and they should be guided to show off their personalities rather than their figures.
Bridget has a different take. She writes, perhaps it would be useful for girls at co-ed schools to be issued oversized T-shirts that say, I am wearing this shirt to conceal myself totally because boys are too stupid to be expected to control their behaviors. Sadly, boys are not being instructed in issues of personal space, polite behavior, or how to focus in the face of distraction.
And our programming director, Franny Bastian, shared this reaction. Your interview about Woodstock Middle School brought me back to my middle school years when the assistant principal would greet us at the door with a ruler to measure how far above the knee our skirts were. As a freshman at South Burlington High, I was among a group of girls who staged a dress code protest by wearing slacks to school. The rule was changed shortly afterward. This was around 1970.
In another recent discussion, we took up the findings in a new report on pay equity in Vermont. The findings follow national trends that show women earn less than men and are steered into certain career paths over others. One listener, Reba, who works in electrical, plumbing, and appliance repair, she says, if it's in a house, I can fix it. She also says she's faced these issues in her career.
Yeah, she wrote to say, when we moved here from Tennessee, I lost about $6 an hour and a free apartment to do similar work here. That was a hard transition, but it wasn't as shocking as the sexist attitudes I've encountered while working in my capacity. Here, I've endured more blatant sexual harassment at work and have even had a man ask me why they let me, a woman, do trades work. Don't get me wrong, though. We love Vermont.
Well, we love hearing your comments, so please keep them coming. Email vermontedition@vpr.net or find us on Twitter and social media elsewhere.
Patty, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And that does it for today's show. Tomorrow, we'll be talking with Vermont's renegade librarian, Jessamine West. She says our libraries are hotbeds of radicalism in a good way, and we need to figure out how to best support them in their mission. Send your questions and comments. If you are a librarian, tell us what you think. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen live tomorrow at noon. Our program is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance today from Haley Labonte-Davy. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.